Welcome back to this, the third lecture in the Wyoming Catholic College distance learning course, Points of Light in the Darkness, the Church in the 19th Century. I'm your professor for this class, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. When we think of the English Reformation, we typically think of Henry VIII and the 1534 Act of Supremacy. Goodbye to the Pope, goodbye to Rome, to monasteries, to Catherine of Aragon. Hello to the king as supreme head of the Church of England, to royal control and ownership of all church properties, to a solution to Henry's money problems, and to marrying Anne Boleyn, who would doubtlessly produce the male heir Catherine was unable to give him. But it's not that simple. When Henry died, he left one son, Edward VI, child not of Anne Boleyn, but of Henry's next wife, Jane Seymour. Edward was a sickly 10-year-old when he became king and probably had no meaningful religious opinions. His protectors, however, moved forward with the Protestant project for the next 6 years while Edward reigned before his death in 1553 at age 15. That's when Mary, daughter of jilted Catherine of Aragon, took over and attempted to re-Catholicize England. That project, alas, went badly, and Mary died in 1558 when her half-sister, Elizabeth I, became queen. Elizabeth found Protestantism, and being head of the Church of England, rather congenial and very useful. She didn't seem to have been a particularly religious woman, but as Mary had gone to war against Protestants, Elizabeth went to war against Catholics. Elizabeth made it an issue of loyalty or treason. If you rejected the Queen as supreme head of the Church of England and remained loyal to a foreign sovereign, aka the Pope, you were a traitor. And traitors are persecuted and/or imprisoned and/or executed. After 44 years as Queen, Elizabeth died childless, and her cousin, James VI of Scotland, became James I of England. He is the James of the King James translation of the Bible. And it was in 1605, during James I's reign, that Catholic Guy Fawkes and his company attempted to blow up Parliament and the King. Remember the 5th of November, gunpowder treason and plot. I see no reason why gunpowder treason should ever be forgot. And it was not forgot. Beginning in 1606, bonfires and fireworks mark Guy Fawkes Day. Whether or not people today know that they are enjoying an anti-Catholic holiday, I don't know. But through the years, most people did. James' son, Charles I, while he may not have been a Catholic himself, married Princess Henrietta Maria of France, who was very Catholic. And though married to the head of the Church of England, she and her entourage had permission to practice their Catholic faith. This, of course, did not endear Charles to his subjects, and finally his Puritan subjects ousted and executed him. Henrietta Maria and her children fled to Catholic France, where, needless to say, the heirs to the throne of England were raised Catholic. Once the so-called Puritan Commonwealth fizzled out, the royal family returned to England and Charles II became king. He was Catholic-ish, but his brother, James, who became king after Charles, was seriously Catholic. As a result, he reigned less than 4 years before being run out of the country and replaced in 1689 by a guaranteed, card-carrying, dyed-in-the-wool, no question about it, Protestant, William of Orange. Pity he spoke very little English. Which is to say that the English Reformation lasted from Henry VIII's break with Rome in 1534 until 1689, 155 years. Well, by 1801, While Catholics were no longer considered dangerous, they were nonetheless still persecuted as, at least, would-be traitors. Catholics couldn't enter the legal profession or politics. No Catholic could serve in Parliament. They couldn't be officers in the Army or Navy. They couldn't attend Oxford or Cambridge. They couldn't send their children overseas for a Catholic education. And owning and inheriting and passing on property was problematic for Catholics. They did, however, get to pay special taxes for their faith. Then in 1828, the Irish elected Daniel O'Connell, a Catholic politician and political activist, to Parliament in spite of the law. This forced a tough political decision. Hold the line on treating Catholics as second-class citizens and risk a civil war, or change the law. They changed the law by passing the Catholic Relief Act of 1829, giving Catholics almost all the civil rights of Protestants. Nonetheless, Catholics were, in the early to mid-19th century, a gens lucifuga, a people of darkness, found in corners and alleys and cellars and the housetops or the recesses of the country, close quote. Those words were written by our next bright point of light, St. John Henry Newman, who was born in London on February 21st, 1801, and baptized into the Church of England that April. His parents seem to have been religious only in what was considered a conventional, respectable English kind of way. But nonetheless, Newman wrote, quote, "I was brought up from a child to take great delight in reading the Bible, but I had no formed religious convictions till I was 15. Of course," he added, "I had a perfect knowledge of the catechism," close quote. And that's not surprising, considering Newman's brilliance as a student. At the boarding school to which John Henry and his brother Charles went in 1807, the headmaster noted that no one ever went through the curriculum as quickly as John Henry Newman. Louis Boyer, in his biography of Newman, writes, quote, "By the 25th of May, 1810, he was doing Ovid and the Greek grammar. By November, he had gone on to Virgil. A day or two before his 10th birthday, he started on Latin verse composition, and about the same time on the violin. Next year, after the Greek New Testament, Homer swam into his ken, followed in 1813 by Herodotus," close quote. Which is to say, John Henry Newman was amazingly smart and highly motivated to academic excellence. Despite being superstitious in a childish sort of way, by the time he was 14, he was reading the rationalists, including Thomas Paine, David Hume, probably some Voltaire, and Alexander Pope's Essay on Man, leading him to a mild skepticism regarding the supernatural and thus the Christian faith. Regarding that skepticism, he said to himself at the time, how dreadful, but how plausible, close quote. Let's pause here and think about this, because it seems to me that we have a window into the most important thing we can say about Newman. The arguments made by these rationalists seem to point to a truth, no God, no supernatural, which young John Henry Newman found uncomfortable. How dreadful, he thought. Dreadful yet plausible. Truth claims demanded attention and consideration, regardless of how uncomfortable they made him. Newman from childhood was a thoughtful person, committed to going wherever truth led him. Reflecting on Newman's life as a whole, Pope Benedict XVI, on the eve of Newman's beatification, September 18th, 2010, noted, quote, At the end of his life, Newman would describe his life's work as a struggle against the growing tendency to view religion as a purely private and subjective matter, a question of personal opinion. Here is the first lesson we can learn from his life. In our day, when an intellectual and moral relativism threatens to sap the very foundations of our society, Newman reminds us that, as men and women, made in the image and likeness of God, we were created to know the truth, to find in that truth our ultimate freedom and the fulfillment of our deepest human aspirations. Close quote. In 1816, Newman's father made a career move from banker to brewer, which entitled a family move from a suburb of London to the town of Alton, about 50 miles to the southwest. And it was decided that young John Henry, rather than adding to the chaos, as all moves tend to be, should spend the school break at school, the lonely boy in an otherwise empty dormitory. There he came under the influence of Reverend Walter Mayers, who he wrote, quote, was the human means of this beginning of divine faith in me, close quote. He listened to Mayers' sermons, had numerous conversations with him, read the books Mayers recommended, all of them evangelical and Calvinistic. He came to believe that all the rationalist skepticism was not just dreadful, but implausible. That was important. Implausible, not uncomfortable. Over time, his Calvinist convictions faded. Scholar Eamon Duffy noted in the New York Review, quote, he came to see evangelicalism with its emphasis on religious feeling and on the Reformation doctrine of justification by faith alone as a Trojan horse for an undogmatic religious individualism that ignored the church's role in the transmission of revealed truth and that must lead inexorably to subjectivism and skepticism. Close quote. But one Calvinist author he read never faded. He was indelible. Newman, in his Apologia Pro Vita Sua, wrote about the author Thomas Scott, quote, what I suppose will strike any reader of Scott's history and writings is his bold unworldliness and vigorous independence of mind. He followed the truth wherever it led him, beginning with Unitarianism and ending in a zealous faith in the Holy Trinity. He followed truth wherever it led him, can and should be said about Newman. In fact, in 1816, at age 15, he became convinced that God's calling in his life, perhaps in foreign missions, required that he remain celibate. And he did. Truth led. John Henry Newman followed. From his prep school, he went to Trinity College, Oxford, and then became a fellow and later tutor at Oriel College, Oxford, a college known for its intellectual vigor. In 1835, Newman was ordained to the Anglican priesthood. And Newman at that time was no friend to the Catholic Church, writing that even as early as 1816, he, quote, became most firmly convinced that the Pope was the Antichrist predicted by Daniel, St. Paul, and St. John, close quote. Visiting Rome in 1832, he remarked in a letter how the city was, quote, the most wonderful place on earth, close quote. But the church was, quote, polytheistic, degrading, and idolatrous, close quote. Not to say that there weren't assorted degrading and idolatrous goings-on in the Church of England. While in that church there was a great deal of lip service given to Christianity, religious faith was conventional and loose rather than central and firmly orthodox. The church's job, to use the old saw, was hatch'em, match'em, and dispatch'em. That is, you went to church for baptisms, weddings, and funerals, and possibly Christmas and Easter, but only possibly. On Easter Sunday, 1800, London's St. Paul's Cathedral, a church designed to hold 3,500, had a grand total of 6 communicants. The Great Awakening of the 1740s and 50s was probably not even a memory by then. A new awakening, a fresh outpouring of the Holy Spirit was needed. On July 14th, 1833, Newman heard his friend John Keble preach a sermon at St. Mary's, Oxford, entitled National Apostasy. Keble compared England to King Saul in 1 Samuel, who, you may remember, disobeyed God and fell under his judgment. In the same way, Keble insisted, the people of England had forsaken the Christian faith, were disobedient to the commands of God, indifferent to matters of religion, and, in all of it, relied on their feelings to make decisions about truth, rather than their reason, in concert with the teachings of the church. About religion, Keble said, quote, "This is not a becoming place, nor are these safe topics for the indulgence of mere feelings," close quote. About Keble's sermon, Newman wrote, quote, "I have ever considered and kept the day as the start of the religious movement of 1833, close quote. The name we give to that movement was the Oxford Movement or the Tractarian Movement, and Newman, writing and editing Tracts for the Times, became one of the movement's primary spokesmen. In addition to being a spiritual awakening, the Oxford Movement sought a clear understanding of the Church of England, the Anglican Church's, place in Christianity broadly defined. Where did Anglicanism fit in among Roman Catholics, Protestants of various sorts, and the Orthodox churches of the East? In his tracts, Newman argued that that Anglicanism was the via media, the middle way between the errors of Protestantism, Baptists, Methodists, Puritans, Evangelicals, on the one hand, and the errors of Roman Catholicism, on the other hand. This is not to say that Anglicanism was a compromise between the two. Rather, Newman and others argued it was a distinct and far better option. Louis Boyer explains, quote, "The Anglican Church is Catholicism in its pristine purity, disencumbered of the parasitic accretions of Rome, rescued from the so-called purification, but in reality, the ruinous ravages of Protestantism," close quote. The idea wasn't new, but it was only an idea, not a living reality. Newman wanted to change that. He wrote, quote, "Protestantism and popery are real religions, but the via media, viewed as an integral system, has scarcely any existence except on paper. I trusted that someday it would prove to be a substantive religion." Newman attempted to show how Anglicanism was dogmatic and sacramental and thus in perfect accord with the early church, while at the same time being something different from Roman Catholicism or Eastern Orthodoxy. He worked hard at it, and that emphasis on dogma and the sacraments became Newman's gateway into the Catholic Church. Preeminent in the Oxford Movement and in Newman's work was again this core belief in truth, specifically the truth of dogma. Some things about God and the Christian faith are true, whether or not you feel good about them. Some things about God and the Christian faith are false, regardless of whether or not you feel great about them. Our feelings, our sentiments, have nothing to do with the truth or error of this or that doctrine. The Great Plague in 19th century Christianity, and still the Great Plague today, Newman called liberalism. Liberalism was first and foremost anti-dogmatic, that is, It drew its conclusions about life and God not from Scripture and the teachings of the Church, but from what Keble had called the indulgence of mere feelings. Years later, as a Catholic, Newman wrote concerning dogma, quote, "The main principle of the Oxford movement is as dear to me now as it ever was. I have changed in many things. In this, I have not. From the age of 15, dogma has been the fundamental principle of my religion. I know no other religion. Religion is mere sentiment, is to me a dream and a mockery." Close quote. In all of his scholarship and writing as an Anglican, Newman immersed himself in the Church Fathers. What did they believe before the Church of Rome made a mess of things? How did they understand and celebrate the sacraments, again, before the Church of Rome made a mess of things? Here's some advice. If you are listening and you are a Protestant and want to avoid becoming Catholic or possibly Eastern Orthodox, avoid immersing yourself in the Church Fathers. It's just not safe. Case in point, John Henry Newman. Quote, "My stronghold was antiquity. Now, here in the middle of the 5th century, I found, as it seemed to me, Christendom of the 16th and 19th century reflected." He began to see that the errors against which the Church Fathers fought were the same errors of his day. Worse than that, they were his own errors. He went on, "It was difficult to make out how the Eutychians or Monophysites were heretics, unless Protestants and Anglicans were heretics too. Difficult to find arguments against the Tridentine Fathers, which did not tell against the Fathers of Chalcedon. Difficult to condemn the popes of the 16th century without condemning the popes of the 5th. With increasing clarity, Newman saw unbridled liberalism among Anglican bishops and priests, along with theological liberalism's concomitant, a willingness to fudge on the sacraments, what they mean, what they do, who may receive them. By 1842, Newman was convinced, writes Boyer, quote, "The Anglican Church was not a church. Of her own accord, she barred her door against Christian faith and sacramental grace." Close quote. Which is not to say that he became a Catholic the next day. While he was committed to dogma, Newman's academic life was partly dedicated to bashing and debunking Catholic dogma. What could he do with that Catholic dogma now? Well, regardless of whether you're a cradle Catholic or a convert, you probably know what was on his list. Mary, the saints, statues and images, transubstantiation, the Pope. Newman also had a deep sense that one ought not leave the church into which one has been baptized, and in this case, ordained. One by one, he worked through his objections until, as he wrote, quote, "I had one final advance of mind to accomplish, and one final step to take. That further advance of mind was to be able honestly to say that I was certain of the conclusions at which I had already arrived. That further step, imperative once such certitude was attained, was my submission to the Catholic Church." Close quote. That took some time, time during which, beginning in 1845, he started his Essay on the Development of Doctrine, promising himself that, quote, "If at the end of it, my convictions in favor of the Roman Church were not weaker, of taking the necessary steps for admission into her fold," close quote. So he researched, and he pondered, and he wrote, until by October of that year, quote, "My difficulties so cleared away that I ceased to speak of the Roman Catholics and boldly called them Catholics. Before I got to the end, I resolved to be received and the book remains in the state in which it was then, unfinished. Newman was received into the Catholic Church on October 9, 1845, and though he initially intended a lay vocation, he was ordained priest in February 1846, when he also received a Doctor of Divinity degree from Pope Pius IX. Newman came into the Catholic Church knowing full well what he would face. The 1840s were still vehemently anti-Catholic. In fact, the Catholic Emancipation Act stirred up flames of hatred that had seemed as though they had died out. Books, speakers, even novels addressed the Catholic problem and the evils of Rome. Not long after Newman came into the church, Giacinto Achilli arrived in England. Achilli was a former Dominican friar whose life story seemed to confirm the very worst of Protestant fears and prejudices. He proved to be a very popular and persuasive speaker. In his 1851 Lectures on the Present Position of Catholics in England, Newman took on Achilli, who was, for the most part, a fraud. But that didn't prevent him from suing Newman for libel. After great effort and expense, Newman was found guilty. Rather than prison, as he feared, he had to pay a fine and had to endure a lecture by the judge, who commented that since becoming a Catholic, Newman had really lost his moral compass. Well, on the plus side, Louis Boyer tells us, quote, "The Times immediately declared that the verdict was a disgrace to British justice, and public opinion in general, despite its religious prejudices, held that Newman was completely justified and Achilli utterly discredited." Well, this was something new. Public opinion swung in a Catholic convert's favor. The needle moved. Then in 1862, Anglican priest and man of letters, Charles Kingsley, made an offhand remark in a book review, quote, "Truth for its own sake has never been a virtue with the Roman clergy. Father Newman informs us that it need not, and on the whole ought not to be, that cunning is the weapon which heaven has given the saints, wherewith to withstand the brute male force of the wicked world which marries and is given in marriage. Whether his notion be doctrinally correct or not, it is at least historically so." Close quote. That is, Kingsley essentially accused Newman of being the anti-Newman, a man who cared little or not at all about truth and was happy, along with all other priests and bishops, to lie. Well, this demanded a response. Even though he had been stung once in the Achilli affair, Newman took up the challenge, first in a series of back-and-forth articles with Kingsley, then in a bi-weekly series of columns that became his spiritual autobiography, Apologia Pro Vita Sua. In that book, he told the story of his religious convictions from youth through his reception into the Catholic Church. And he told his story in such a gracious, kind way that it evoked, and it continues to evoke, sympathy among his readers. Perhaps because of it, it was and continues to be a way station on the road from Protestantism to the Catholic Church. How so? In his introduction to Newman's Apologia, Ian Kerr wrote, quote, "What Newman is considering in his general defense of the Roman Catholic Church is really the question of authority and freedom. as against the modern assumption that freedom, by definition, means the absence of checks and limitations, except such as may incidentally be imposed by conflict between opposing freedoms, Newman's case is that freedom demands boundaries, because these actually define its nature. Otherwise, it degenerates into anarchy and thus destroys itself. Close quote. Newman has persuaded many, myself included, and the influence of his apologia went a long way toward changing public opinion in order to make life for Catholics in England increasingly and finally free. Let me mention a few more instances of Newman's lasting influence. First, Newman's The Idea of a University, written when he served as rector of the Catholic University of Ireland, has been read and reread with great benefit by the founders of schools such as Thomas Aquinas College, Thomas More College, Magdalen College, Christendom College, Wyoming Catholic College, and also the founders of many Catholic classical high schools. The true university, wrote Newman, quote, educates the intellect to reason well in all matters, to reach out toward truth and to grasp it. Amen and amen. Second example, Queen Victoria. Newman's queen reigned from 1837 to 1902. As queen, she was head of the Church of England. Nonetheless, on her bedstand, as she was dying, was a copy of Newman's poem, Dream of Gerontius, a meditation on death from a very Catholic point of view. Jesu Maria, I am near to death, and thou art calling me, I know it now, not by the token of this faltering breath, this chill at heart, this dampness on my brow. Jesu, have mercy, Mary, pray for me. 'Tis this new feeling, never felt before. Be with me, Lord, in my extremity. That I am going, that I am no more. 'Tis this strange innermost abandonment. Lover of souls, great God, I look to thee. This emptying out of each constituent and natural force by which I come to be. Third example. Coming out of the Victorian era is the prominent Catholic journalist, G.K. Chesterton, who you have no doubt read or at least know about. In the first chapter of Chesterton's book, Victorian Age in Literature, he focuses on Newman and his influence, an influence that extended to Chesterton, also a convert to Catholicism. So if you love Chesterton, keep in mind that behind much of Chesterton's thinking was Newman. Final example. In the midst of Adolf Hitler's Third Reich, Sophie Scholl joined the anti-Nazi White Rose movement. While the film about her, called Sophie Scholl, is a good one and tells the story well of this young woman and her bravery and her brave friends, it fails to mention her strong Christian faith, a faith that was influenced by her reading of John Henry Newman. She even gave two volumes of Newman's sermons to her boyfriend as a going-away gift after he was drafted. George Weigel notes concerning Sophie Scholl's trial and execution, quote, when Sophie Scholl was tried before the notorious People's Court in Munich by Roland Freisler, a Nazi gangster masquerading as judge, she testified that it was her conscience and her Christian conviction that had led her into nonviolence resistance to the Hitler regime and its wars of aggression. And Sophie Scholl's Christian conscience was formed in part by a serious intellectual and spiritual encounter with John Henry Newman. Close quote. Early 19th century England was not a happy place for Catholics. Yet God ignited a wonderful point of light in St. John Henry Newman, and things began to change. Newman is a point of light that is still there to illuminate God's people and his church. As Pope St. John Paul II wrote, quote, Newman's long life shows him to have been an ardent disciple of truth. The unfolding of his career confirms the single-heartedness of his aims as expressed in the following words, which he made his own. Quote, my desire hath been to have truth for my chiefest friend and no enemy but error. Close quote. In periods of trial, John Paul went on, and suffering, he persevered with confidence, knowing that time was on the side of truth. Close quote. Next week, having already crossed the English Channel, we'll cross the Atlantic to New York City and its first Archbishop, Dagger John Hughes. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.